Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Okay, reading this morning from 1.3.24 in the list of incarnations. This is Lord Buddha. I'm going to read the verse and purport, and it's three-page-long purport. Prabhupada has a lot to say about Lord Buddha. Then, Tata, in the beginning of Kali Yuga, Kalo Sampravartate, the Lord will appear as Lord Buddha, the son of Anjana, in the province of Gaya, just for the purpose of deluding those who are envious of the faithful theist. Samohaya Suradvisham. Sura Dvisham, those who are envious of the atheists, envious of the faithful theists. Sura Dvisham, for the purpose of deluding Sura Dvisham, those who are envious of the faithful theists. So, interestingly, Prabhupada writes in the purport, Lord Buddha is the emblem of theism. Do you see a contradiction? Let's see how he resolves that. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Lord Buddha, a powerful incarnation, that means Shaktivesh, of the personality of Godhead appeared in the province of Gaya, Bihar, as the son of Anjana, and he preached his own conception of nonviolence and deprecated even lights out. Okay. Fantastic. Let me have it. Deprecated even the animal sacrifices sanctioned in the Vedas at the time when Lord Buddha appeared. The people in general were atheistic and preferred animal flesh to anything else. On the plea of Vedic sacrifice, every place was practically turned into a slaughterhouse, and animal killing was indulged in unrestrictedly. Lord Buddha preached nonviolence, taking pity on the poor animals. He preached that he did not believe in the tenets of the Vedas and stressed the adverse psychological effects incurred by animal killing. Less intelligent men of the age of Kali, who had no faith in God, followed his principle, and for the time being, they were trained in moral discipline and nonviolence. Can you turn that away? Turn it away. It's kind of blinding. Thank you. That's good. For the time being, they were trained in moral discipline and nonviolence, the preliminary steps for proceeding further on the path of God realization. That's how he gets that Buddha is the emblem of theism, and that he was deluding those who were envious of the faithful theists. Theists meaning belief in God. So You don't have, you know, forget the Vedas. Forget God. Just follow me. Be theistic. Or be, you know, moralistic, which is the threshold or the preliminary steps for proceeding further on the path of God realization. Okay? He deluded the atheists because such atheists who followed his principles did not believe in God, but they kept their absolute faith in Lord Buddha, who himself was the incarnation of God. Thus, the faithless people were made to believe in God in the form of Lord Buddha. Forget the Vedas, follow me. Then he said some of the same things that are in the Vedas, but not misapplied. And even today, their Buddhist teachings are misapplied rampantly. That was the mercy of Lord Buddha, : he made the faithless faithful to him. I'll read the sentence again. That was the mercy of Lord Buddha. He made the faithless faithful to him. Believing in God in the form of Lord Buddha without believing in God. Paragraph. Killing of animals before the advent of Lord Buddha was the most prominent feature of the society. People claimed that these were Vedic sacrifices. When the Vedas are not accepted through the authoritative disciplic succession, the casual reader of the Vedas, the casual readers of the Vedas are misled by the flowery language of that system of knowledge. Now, when the casual readers, he's not just speaking of, you know, everyday people on the street. He's speaking of the brahmanas having not heard in disciplic succession, or the scholars having not heard in disciplic succession, how they, what conclusions they reach. So we have these two very clearly stated within Bhagavad Gita, the position of those that hear in disciplic succession, the position of those that don't. So in the second chapter, Krishna speaks about, and Prabhupada is summarizing here, those that don't. He calls them the casual readers, are misled by the flowery language of that system of knowledge. In the Bhagavad Gita, a comment has been made on such foolish scholars. Avipashchitaha. Avipashchitaha is those who are Avipashchitaha. Bhagavad Gita. They have no depth of knowledge. It's around chapter 2, text 46, something in that 36, 46. Here it is, 42. Men of small knowledge, that's Avipashchitaha, 242 and 43. Yam imam pushpitam vacham pravadanti Avipashchitaha. Men of small knowledge are very much attached to the flowery words of the Vedas, which recommend various fruitive activities for elevation to heavenly planets, result in good birth, power, and so forth. Being desirous of sense gratification and opulent life, they say, there is nothing more than this. So this is the Vedavada Rata verse. What do we know? How does Prabhupada use this Vedavada Rata? He conventionally or regularly would speak of it as the so-called followers of the Vedas. Vedavada Rata. That's how he's done the word for word. Supposed followers of the Vedas. Who are in the category of Vipaschitta, who are the poor fund of knowledge. Avipaschitta. Vipaschitta and Avipaschitta. So, let's step back. And who are those that understand the purpose of the Vedas properly? Those that have heard in the cyclic succession. Those that understand the purpose of the Vedas from one who knows the purpose of the Vedas. That's Krishna. What does Krishna say is the purpose of the Vedas? That he quotes next. 15:15 Bhagavad Gita. According to the Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Vedaish Jasaira Vair Ahameva Vedya. The whole system of the Vedas is to lead one gradually to the path of the Supreme Lord. So now, that's what Buddha was doing. Those were taking one away from the Supreme Lord by saying, oh, look at this. The Vedas have a system for sacrifice of animals. Open up the slaughterhouses. Mass killing of animals. But no, that's irrational. It's not what the Vedas authorized. But when the purpose of the Vedas is lost, and this is what Prabhupada is going to explain, I'll read it a few times, but the point he's drilling on here is, when the purpose of the Vedas is lost, someone can pick up something over here and over there and over there, and feel this is Vedic, if it's missing the purpose of the Vedas, it's guaranteed to be distorted, if not grossly distorted, in the form of open up the slaughterhouses. So, what did Buddha do? He tricked the atheists. He deluded those who are envious of the faithful theist. The faithful theist is not the one that says, open up the slaughterhouses. The faithful theist is the one that abides by the principles that say everything is meant to take us to the Supreme Lord. So those that were the Sura Dvisham, envious of the theists, the faithful theists, he said, forget the Vedas. Now, act in such a way it will prepare you to come to the Supreme Lord. He will prepare you to come to that path that leads to the Supreme Lord. The whole theme of Vedic literature is to know the Supreme Lord, the individual soul, and the cosmic situation in relation and the relation between all these items. Okay. God, the living entity, and Prakriti. Right? Ishvara, Jiva, and Prakriti. And the relation between them. I'm going to read this sentence twice, so listen carefully. When the relation is known, the relative function begins. And as a result of such function, the ultimate goal of life, or going back to Godhead, takes place in the easiest manner. So, in one sense, he's saying sambandha avideya prayojana. But he doesn't use the language. He just says, the whole of the Vedic literature is to help us understand or bring us to the understanding of the relation between the living entity and God, between matter and God, and the interrelation between them in relation to God. when this relation is known, the relative function, that's the functioning within that relationship, acting within that relationship. And as a result of such function, the ultimate goal of life, or going back to Godhead, takes place in the easiest manner. So proper sambandha jnana is necessary. When there isn't, conversely, when there isn't proper sambandha jnana, guaranteed, one will get a misunderstanding of proper conduct and a path to reach whatever is one considers to be the goal, because the goal hasn't been properly understood. Unfortunately, unauthorized scholars of the Vedas become captivated by the purificatory ceremonies only, and natural progress is thereby checked. He doesn't write this, but there are two categories of such persons: those that are wanting elevation and those that are wanting liberation. There are persons who the liberationists, the impersonalists, who they prefer the Upanishads because in their estimation, Gyan Yoga is the ultimate. It's for people who have strong intellects, like us. You know, we're at the top of the pile. We have strong intellects, and the purpose of the Vedas is to know Brahman. And within the act of sacrifice, which is for people who are weaker-minded, the act of sacrifice can also connect one to Brahman. And the essence is Brahman. And those that don't know that the essence is Brahman, they want the sacrifices so that they can get some material elevation. But better that they cultivate knowledge than the sacrifice of the Vedas. Because when we ask those persons, very good sacrifices mentioned throughout the Vedas, then the question for us to you is, sacrifice unto whom? And their answer is, not unto whom. Just sacrifice. Yajna. So they look at the Karmakanda rituals as for people who are weak-minded and they need some flowery things to do. And then, you know, it'll help them become prepared on the progressive path to Brahman realization. That's how they view the structure of the Vedas. And then you graduate from kindergarten, you come into Gyan Yoga. And in Gyan Yoga, you don't worry about the flowery language. You just, you know, fix on yourself in Brahman. Read Vedanta Sutra, renounce the world and so forth. So, at Buddha's time, there were persons who had deviated from the Vedic standard and were seeing the Vedic authorization of animal sacrifice to be, no, it's bona fide, it's authorized. And so Lord Buddha came and checked that tendency. To such bewildered persons of atheistic propensity, Lord Buddha is the emblem of theism. He therefore first of all wanted to check the habit of animal killing. The animal killers are dangerous elements on the path going back to Godhead. Then very briefly, Prabhupada brings up there are two types of animal killers. Two types of animal killers. So this, he explained, the soul is sometimes called the animal, quote unquote, or the living being. Who knows the third mantra of Ishopanishad, or Atmahana, that is used? Asurya namate loka antena tamasavritaha. Yeke chatmahano janaha. Tamste pretya bigachanti. Yeke chatmahano janaha. So, Atmahana is the killer of the soul, Atmahana, but it can also be the killer of animals. That's why he says it's the two types of animal killers. The soul is sometimes called the animal or the living being. Therefore, both the slaughter of animals and those who have lost their identity of soul are animal killers. And in the purport to that verse, Prabhupada speaks in similar language about these two types. Paragraph. Now, this is a Bhagavatam reference. Maharaj Parikshit said that only the animal killer cannot relish the transcendental message of the Supreme Lord. Pashugnat is the phrase. He's describing the process of hearing and chanting and how wonderful it is and how beneficial it is to the living entity, and who will not be attracted except for the animal killers. Therefore, if people are to be educated on the path of Godhead, they must be taught first and foremost in italics to stop the process of animal killing, as above mentioned, still italicized. It is nonsensical to say that animal killing has nothing to do with spiritual realization. He's referring to some of his contemporaries or near contemporaries who were saying that he, you know, didn't want to give their names, then he reluctantly gave their names, of persons who said eating doesn't have anything to do with God realization. You can eat anything and be God realized. There's nothing, you know, there's no restriction for people who are eating this or eating that. They can be good people, and good people can realize God. There are people that spoke like that, you know, proponents of the Vedas. I don't know how strong of an issue it is here in India, but it's becoming an increasingly prominent issue for people of Indian origin who are now in the West. And you know, an obstacle for them is the social stigma of becoming vegetarians again. Now, for Americans, it's not a problem because it's like it's cool to be vegetarian. But for Indians living in the West, for some, that have kind of like merged, lost their identity and merged with the American culture, it's difficult for them, for some. By this dangerous theory that animal killing has nothing to do with spiritual realization, many so-called sannyasis have sprung up by the grace of Kali Yuga who preach animal killing under the garb of the Vedas. The subject matter has already been discussed in the conversations between Lord Chaitanya and Maulana Chankazi Shaheb, Maulana Chankazi Shaheb. Never heard Prabhupada use that whole nomenclature. But you know that discussion. The discussion says, my dear Kazi, why in your scriptures does it endorse killing your mother? That's not a good religious teaching. You kill your mother in the form of a cow, and the opposing argument was, in your Vedas it also speaks of cow killing, so why are you faulting me? It doesn't speak of cow killing, it speaks of sacrifice of the cow and rejuvenating the old cow to a young cow, not killing the cow for eating the cow. And in the age of Kali, because there aren't qualified brahmanas, it's forbidden. So in your scripture is killing of the cow. That's killing of mother. What kind of principle is this? And Chankazi said, you're right. And Lord Chaitanya said, and even that principle, or maybe it's either in his statement or in the commentary. In the Quran, there is the beginning part is pravritti, and the concluding part is nivritti. So the concluding part says, actually, it's better to not kill the animal. Better to be vegetarian. The former part is, if you can't control yourself, here's the procedure. And it's actually better to... So it's restriction, not endorsement, the sacrifice part. But it shouldn't be sacrifice of mother. The animal sacrifice, as stated in the Vedas, is different from the unrestricted animal killing in the slaughterhouse. Because the asuras, or the so-called scholars of Vedic literature, put forward the evidence of animal killing in the Vedas, Lord Buddha superficially denied the authority of the Vedas. This rejection of the Vedas by Lord Buddha was adopted in order to save the people from the vice of animal killing, as well as to save the poor animals from the slaughtering process of their big brothers who clamor for universal brotherhood, peace, justice, and equity. There is no justice when there is animal killing. In one of the PowerPoint presentations that I make, this very same statement that Prabhupada is making in the purport here, it is quoted from Isaac Basevich Singer, who was a Nobel Prize winner in literature, who says basically the same, you know, people clamor for peace and justice. They'll never have peace and justice as long as they're taking the lives of innocent animals. It will never happen. Which is what Prabhupada is saying. Lord Buddha wanted to stop it completely, and therefore his cult of ahimsa was propagated not only in India, but also outside the country. So, how do we align ourselves with the animal rights people? We don't. We recognize any more than we align ourselves with the Buddhists. We recognize that it's a sub-religious principle that's meant that its value is specifically insofar as it leads to God consciousness. So there's an overlap, but it's not, you know, where we buddy up with the animal rights movement. But we see its value in relation to restoring the principles of theism within society. However, it can work the other way. You know, people can become, you know, entrenched atheists without God. But that's a very, very prominent point of view going back for actually for, you know, like past 15 or so years. It's even got a name. It's called postmodernity. I'm not so familiar with it, but I have a nephew who's my brother's son is an attorney and an evangelical Christian, and every now and then we have some interaction. And skipping some detail, but he was sharing with me. He feels very strongly about this, that there is an opposition to theism, and amongst intellectuals there is. And it goes like this: it's not so much this brand, that brand, or the other brand. We don't mind. We don't have something against this group, that group, or the other group. We have an issue with God, and God should be out. You can have ahimsa all you like. You can have vegetarianism all you like. You can have, you know, veganism all you like. Just, you know, take this intellectually unsubstantiated and unsubstantiatable thing of God and, you know, put it where it belongs. It moves a lot of people. And it's like going back to what Prabhupada says here. The whole theme of Vedic literature is to know the Supreme Lord, the individual soul, and the cosmic situation, and the relation between each of these items. You leave God out of the picture, and it's romper room. It's children in children's brains and adult bodies deciding world policy. I'll give an example. Just one little example. But when I was visiting the Illinois Institute of Technology, also known as IIT, there was a group of people, a large group of people, that did some fair amount of advertising, and there were three Chinese students all doing their doctorate studies. So I was interested to see what attracted them to come, and we sat down and spent some time with them after the talk. And they had a lot of questions. And it was not just kind of the information type of questions. They were good questions, but there was one who was kind of like more domineering type of person than the others, so he started speaking about why you don't need God. You just need to do good. You don't need God. And so I said, okay, let's look at why you need God this way. What's your standard of good? And what's his standard of good? And what's my standard of good? Let's see if we have equal views on what's good. And we, you know, I said, what about capital punishment? Is it good? Or is it not good? What about abortion? Is it good? Or is it not good? He said, abortion is good. Okay, let me hear your explanation of why abortion is good. In China, how many billion people there are? And so there's some poor peasant lady, and you know the Chinese government has said if this poor peasant lady has a child, it will be, you know, a husbandless woman with a small child. Rather than the state becomes the ward of the child, abortion. So abortion is good. After all, there's limited resources. in this one country. It's, although China's a big piece of land, it's got lots of mountains, uninhabitable, and limited resources, abortion's good. So I said, okay, what if you were the child in that woman's womb? Would you say it's good? I said, I didn't think about it that way, but... It's good. It's good. I said, you're not thinking clearly here. You can't say that. You wouldn't say it's good. And then what about God? You know, let's assume for a moment that there's a God. It's called sin. You take the life of another, and while it looks like convenient for the Chinese government, or and the girl, and the father of the child, it's actually bad for all three. What to speak of the doctor? What to speak of you who think it's good? There is some. If there's God and there's sinful, then you're punishable. Well, you're thinking it's good. So how, what's so? Now let's go back to: is there a standard of what is good? If you don't need God. What's the standard of what is good? The Veda says the standard is God establishes the standard of what is good. Dharmam hi saksha. So there's a lot of like really basic education. This is what I learned from the month that I just spent visiting colleges in the U.S. There's a lot of basic education that's missing. And it's pretty much a free marketplace of ideas. I heard so many, you know, nicely articulated foolish ideas just through discussions. The foundation of just things that, at least when I was a kid growing up, they were just like standard. It's gone now. I could spin out for some time sharing with you some of the ideas that I heard, but there's a lot of work to be done on really foundational things. So the purport here is very appropriate. I'll read it one more time. The whole theme of Vedic literature is to know the Supreme Lord, the individual soul, the cosmic situation, and the relation between all these items. When the relation is known, the relative function begins. And as a result of such a function, the ultimate goal of life, or going back to Godhead, takes place in the easiest manner. So it's important to teach people Sambandha Gyan. It's important for the Bhagavatam to emphasize it again and again and yet again and yet again. It's not some obscure notion. It's, you know, it's a scientific and, you know, a very clear notion. Buddha tossed that out. Just follow me. Follow principles of nonviolence. But you know, those principles of nonviolence are also changing. Although it's a clear basic tenet, Dalai Lama is not a vegetarian. And so forth. It's like, you know, Mahatma Gandhi picking up a gun. It's like, you know, or a follower of Gandhi picking up a gun. Anyway. Technically, Lord Buddha's philosophy is called atheistic because there's no acceptance of the Supreme Lord and because that system of philosophy denied the authority of the Vedas. But, secret, that is an act of camouflage by the Lord. Lord Buddha is an incarnation of Godhead. As such, he is the original propounder of Vedic knowledge. He therefore cannot reject Vedic philosophy, but he rejected it outwardly because of Sura Dvisha, or the demons who are always envious of the devotees of Godhead, trying to support cow killing or animal killing from the pages of the Vedas. And this is now being done by the modernized sannyasis. He doesn't mention the name. Lord Buddha had to reject the authority of the Vedas altogether. This is simply technical, and had it been so, he would not have been so accepted as the incarnation of Godhead, nor would he have been worshipped in transcendental songs by the poet Jayadeva, who was a Vaishnavacharya. Lord Buddha preached the preliminary principles of the Vedas in a manner suitable for the time being, and so also did Shankaracharya, in parentheses, to establish the authority of the Vedas. Therefore, before Lord Buddha and Acharya Shankara paved the path of theism, the Vaishnava Acharya, specifically Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, led the people on the path towards a realization of going back to Godhead. Paragraph. We are glad that people are taking interest in the nonviolent movement of Lord Buddha, but will they take the matter very seriously and close the animal slaughterhouses altogether? In italics, if not, there is no meaning to the Ahimsa cult. Paragraph. Two sentences. Last paragraph. Srimad Bhagavatam was composed just prior to the beginning of the age of Kali, about 5,000 years ago, and Lord Buddha appeared about 2,600 years ago. Therefore, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Buddha is foretold. Such is the authority of this clear scripture. There are many prophecies, and they're being fulfilled one after another. They will indicate the positive standing of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is without trace of mistake, illusion, cheating, and imperfection, which are the four flaws of all conditioned souls. Liberated souls are above these flaws, therefore they can see and foretell things which are to take place on distant future dates. So, end of purport, 3 pages worth. It's been described, I'll end with this. It's been described that the sequence of Kali's influence, Buddha's appearance, toss out the Vedas, bring in nonviolence principles, Shankaracharya basically teaching the same thing, a covered form of Buddhism, Sahotra Swami once did it like a very simplified mathematical equation, what Buddha's teachings were and the terms that he used. And then he placed the same simple equation with Shankaracharya's teachings, and it's the same teaching, just different terminology. And so instead of saying nirvana is the goal, he used Brahman is the goal. But his idea of even what is Brahman is not a proper understanding of what is Brahman. It's a speculated idea of Brahman. And following Shankara's teachings will not take one to Brahman. It'll take one to a not matter position, which is what voidism is. What is Brahman? It's what matter isn't. It's what duality isn't. So it's shunyavadi, just covered. So it has another name, nirvishesh. That kind of impersonalism. So Shankara restored the credibility of the Vedas, but taught basically the same teaching, and then following him the four Sampradaya Acharyas that one by one established not only the Vedas but the Supreme Lord. So the importance of the four Sampradayas, although there's differences amongst them, is their systematic reestablishing the supremacy of the personality of Godhead. And then Lord Chaitanya establishing, within that relationship and function, then comes, well, love of God. The others also taught, certainly Ramanujacharya taught love for the personality of Godhead. But love in its highest form through Lord Chaitanya's teaching, the love of the Brijvasis, the residents of Vrindavan, Krishna's wonderful Vrindavan pastimes, which appear to contradict, to the sharp moralist, they appear to contradict teachings of theology. Krishna's stealing butter, and Krishna's running from the battlefield, and Krishna's dancing with the gopis. Krishna's marrying 16,000 wives. Sounds like an irreligious, lusty person from the sharp moralist's perspective. Okay. Can you put that on hold for a second? Yes.
It seems that Lord Buddha's teachings, they only take one step towards that ultimate goal. Really this shift towards theism or acceptance of Supreme Lord in some form does not come at all.
Not at all. There's no mention one way or the other. It's not a denial of. There's no mention one way or the other. Similarly, the soul. I'd like one time, but I'll take the opportunity when it arises to find out. I've asked people in general, Chinese people that were grown up in Buddhism. Well, I guess that's some testimony. Illinois Institute of Technology. University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. I did a presentation on the science of reincarnation. And a lot of Chinese students came, and I spoke with them afterwards and asked them what encouraged them to come. They said, because in our religion, Buddhism, there's also mention of reincarnation, but I've never really understood it so well. So I wanted to come and hear this discussion on reincarnation. So I asked them, in your understanding of reincarnation, what is it that's reincarnating? And they didn't know. They just, they know that it's a teaching of Buddhism, that there's reincarnation. And in fact, there is no mention of the soul, so it's just a principle. But the goal following the completion of the cycle of reincarnation is nirvana. And what's that? You just merge into nothingness. So what is it that's reincarnating? Nothing. Not a very hopeful teaching. What exists? Nothing. What's reincarnating? Nothing. What's the meaning of life? Nothingness. So then why have ahimsa? If nothing, there's the nothingness is the ultimate meaning. There's no handle on it. It's a good way to live. You shouldn't hurt other people. Well, why? What does it matter if nothingness is the ultimate? I can punch you in the nose or shake your hand. It's the same. It's because there's no meaning. On what basis should there be ahimsa? It's just universal understanding of that's a good way to live. While you're living in this world of nothingness, be nice. Don't hurt other beings. Not that I disagree that you shouldn't hurt other beings, but on what basis? So someday maybe I'll have an opportunity to discuss. Okay. Anything else?
Curious question, Maharaj. I have seen some Chinese temple. I don't know whether they're Buddhist or not. But the mode of worship seems to be quite, like a copy of what we do. They have incense, and there is a figure like a Buddha with four heads. And once I asked also, who is this? They said, he is a creator. So, are they Buddhist or what these people are? These people who are Chinese, who are worshipping.
There's so many, it's just like, what's a Hindu? It's like, what's a Buddhist? So there's so many. Conservatives. It's like those who are Jewish, they have, there's the Reformed, and then there's the, more strict, and, as far as the very strict, that's not Judaism. That's like, garbage. But it's Judaism. It's in the bigger umbrella of, the certain parts of their teachings. So, in that broader sense, they're Buddhists. But then there's, within Buddhists, there's many. And then there are persons who say this is the real one, and others say no, this is the real one, and they say no, this is the real one. So that, scholars have divided it. There's this kind of Buddhism, that kind of Buddhism, that kind of Buddhism. But the basic is worship, and what Prabhupada is saying here in italics is they stop their animal slaughter and close the slaughterhouses. That's on the governmental level. But individuals don't participate in animal slaughter in any form. So it's a form of Buddhism. That very strict persons would say, no, that's not. You could ask them, in addition to your worship, what are the teachings that you follow? What books do you study? And you could ask them, are you making an effort to make sure you're getting something that's original, not distorted over time? Like everything gets distorted over time. And from that kind of discussion, you might say, would you be interested to know that Buddha is mentioned in the writings that I study? Oh, very interesting. Yes, it predicts his coming thousands of years. Oh, very interesting. What province he would appear in, what his mother's name would be. Oh, very interesting. May I see? And here's what it says about what he taught. Often, two things. Persons who have a certain practice, they can't think of anything other than that practice. It's just habit. It's just a habit. Where it came from, it's a habit. They can easier change their eating habits. They can change their worship and ritual habits. And another thing is, once someone has become a mindless atheist, it's hard for them to become a theist. Like this Chinese student, got out of the picture, but be good. But you can take people down the path as far as they're willing to go. but don't expect that they're going to, as a result, they're going to change their habits. But, you know, the seed can be there. And it's persons who really want to grow spiritually are the persons that are going to grow spiritually. They'll grow from that position to the next position, because that's what it's intended. That's to lead them to the next position. Try to understand what you're doing in the context of the greater picture of things. Then comes Sambandh again. You know, where does everything come from? And maybe they bought into Big Bang, or maybe they bought into, you know, came from nothing, or maybe, you know, but then you can address Sambandh again, that's, you know, for at least for persons that are willing to be thoughtful. Anything else? Yes.
In daily life, we see that many people, they, when they are out, like our campus, so they will be behaving like a priest, but in their personal life, they will be worshipping something or.
Yeah.
So why they are so insecure as well?
Insecure? Consistent. Inconsistent. One of the reasons why, a big reason why, is the why questions they don't have answers to. They understand that being religious is good, that much they got. But what does being religious mean? So being religious means you do some rituals. So it's called secularism. Secularism means this part of my life is for God. The rest of part of my life is separate. And the religious part of my life is to build piety so that I have more punya points in my treasury and thus I can prosper. And we know what the purpose of prosperity is. Sense enjoyment. Dharma, artha, kama. So that's, you know, that's how it goes. So the purpose of Dharma is not artha for the purpose of sense gratification. But, you know, that's the limit of what they can understand. Or like what Prabhupada wrote in the purport about persons who are attracted to the flowery language of the Vedas. And for what is the purpose of that flowery language of the Vedas besides it's poetically attractive? It's to enhance my position so that I can have better sense gratification. And even the sense, you know, so the disconnect, the inconsistency is how the senses are to be engaged by a religious person. There's no training. Besides, you know, you do what your mother or your grandmother did, puja-wise, in your home in the, every morning or something. How to engage the senses as a religious person engages their senses. Acts of charity, that's something that they understand. At least some people understand. So doing acts of charity. So that gets on the platform of the body, feeding people, hospitals, and so on. Okay? And even those people then can do wanton things. thinking, you know, that I've got my punya points. That entitles me to my wantonness. Now I have a license. It's very shallow. And as you say, inconsistent. It's in intellectual language, it's called secularism. I learned that word from Harvey Cox, a professor at Harvard Divinity School in Christianity, who liked the Hare Krishna movement a lot, because the Hare Krishnas are not secular. It's not this much is for God and the rest is for myself. He wrote a book called Secular City. I didn't read his book. But it's his complaining about Christianity, his appraisal of how Christianity has become secular. And the consequence of it in the life of a practicing Christian. So the same for practicing Hindu that does something this much for God and that much for me. And separating the two. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada, he died.